KSDP, 830 AM in Sandpoint, K201DA, 88.1 FM in King Cove, KOLD, 91.9 FM in Cold Bay, KFPS, 88.1 FM in Falls Pass, and KKQA, 88.1 FM in Accutan, Alaska.
You're tuned into KAEB 91.9 FM. All music, all the time.
Hey to all you fish enthusiasts out there. Whether you're an avid angler or just curious about fish, we'd like to welcome you to Fish of the Week, your audio almanac of all the fish. It's Monday, June 16th, 2025, and we're on a week-by-week tour of fish across the country with guests from all walks of life. I'm Katrina Liebeck with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and my co-host is Guy Arrow.
And this week, we're going to be talking about the rainbow darter, a fish that is very close to my heart.
And for this episode, we're really happy to have Cody Cromer. Cody is a native fish enthusiast, an aquarium keeper, micro fisherman, and lifeless angler from Ohio. So very warm welcome.
Yeah, thank you guys for having me. I'm a kind of a longtime listener, first time here, so I'm glad to be here. Guy, do you remember me at all?
I remember 4 years ago at the Conasauga snorkel hole running into you. I wasn't sure if you would remember. I was going to bring it up.
Yeah, definitely. I remembered. I think I still have your phone number. I don't think I've texted you since I got it, but I kind of keep up with you through the podcast and hearing about what you're doing anyway, so...
Yeah, I got your phone number too somewhere. I am in phone chaos right now, so I actually don't have any phone numbers of anybody. I keep getting texts from people and I have no idea who they are. I have to put together the context. Even Katrina for a while, I'm like,
oh no,
I figured it out. So I'm glad
this person texting me fish questions.
Well, no, I usually with the context be able to put it together. But no, I'm glad that we've finally come full circle and we've got you on the show because, yeah, you're a micro fisherman extraordinaire. I'm very eager to pick your brain and learn more about fishing for this darter and darters in general and just your whole experience.
Okay, so rainbow darter sounds lovely. What do these fish look like? Like, how big are they? And are they always beautiful? Or are there, like, certain times of year or certain ages or certain genders where they really just kind of pop and get that rainbow name?
Yeah, that's a good question. They're related to walleye and yellow perch, a couple of fish that people are a lot more familiar with. They're in the perch family, so they got that same basic body shape. Rainbow darters, though, they stay about 2.5 to 3 inches long. These are really small fish that stay on the stream bottom. A lot of them get very colorful. Rainbow darters in particular, the males get sort of blue on their cheek. They'll get blue vertical bars down their body. Intersecting those bars, they get some reds. And then in their medial fins, they'll get red and blue bands and just variations of red and blue. So a lot of red, blue, and orange.
Beautiful.
Yeah, yeah. The males in particular will get a lot of that color. And they keep and retain that color throughout much of the year. The females, on the other hand, you can see some red and blue in their spiny dorsal fin for much of the year. But other than that, a lot of times they're more of a kind of tannish brown color. From above, they do have some darker saddles, the male and female. So if you're looking down at one, you can usually tell that from a lot of other darters in that respect as well.
If someone was going to be going out in the field looking for this fish, what kind of habitat should they key in on and look for?
Typically, they're going to be found in small to medium-sized streams, clear streams, usually gravel bottom substrate. They're usually fairly abundant when found throughout their range. You can find them in shallow pools. A lot of times you'll find them in riffles if you're netting. It's harder to fish a riffle for such a small fish just because you can't see them. And a lot of times you're sight fishing when you're looking for these fish. The glide right above a riffle, just upstream of a riffle, that's a really good place to look because they like that flow and you can actually see through it. So that's a really fun place to find them. You can find them all over. They're pretty common, but they definitely have a little bit of preference for some current.
What are they doing? Are they kind of darting around like a darter? Are they like foraging? Or what kind of behaviors might you see in those areas that you just described?
A lot of the times they like to kind of hide around rocks. I love watching and looking for darters because they'll kind of peek their head up at you and it almost seems like they're staring right at you. They very well maybe. Sometimes they just are slithering around rocks, especially when they're spawning and you can see a male chasing a female. Every once in a while you'll get to see a couple males duking it out. But otherwise you can find them just under rocks if you can tempt them with a bait or something else, or if you're just netting under rocks and around rocks and riffles, that's just a great place to find them.
And when you say duking it out, how does a fish do that?
It almost just looks like they're bumping into each other and tussling, nothing too crazy. They don't have any fists or anything, so they use what they got.
I was doing some snorkeling in Tennessee with a philosophy professor and part-time snorkeler, and he got some great video of some rainbow darters circling around the males, kind of nipping at each other, going back and forth. It was really cool. And the reason I brought up in the intro, it is a fish that's close to my heart. On that same trip, the very first darter I ever caught was a rainbow darter, and I felt so proud of myself until I then go and see people like Cody who've caught dozens upon dozens of species. And don't make me feel bad, but they inspire me to go out and do more. I am curious. So you mentioned fishing for this fish and sight fishing for it. If you were targeting this as an angler, what kind of special gear would you kind of have? I've heard some folks like to go out at night in particular for darters. I haven't done it myself. But yeah, if you were planning a trip specifically looking for darters and the rainbow darter in particular, what would you do?
Yeah, so a rainbow darter, they're actually one of the slightly easier ones to catch. They're fairly aggressive. A lot of the closer related ones to them, like orange throat darters, are also fairly easy to catch. They're very aggressive. You can usually just catch them on a worm. I always tell people it's a super easy hobby to get into because realistically, you don't need a rod. You could technically hand line if you want, but really just stick, get some light fishing line, and then buy some fly fishing hooks, smaller size hooks in like the 20 to 30 size range. Maybe a small split shot. You could find worms on your own even. Just a little bit of worm on the end of one of those hooks and you just start looking. Usually fishing for darters, it's pretty active. You're doing a lot of sight fishing, not as much just sitting out there and trying to wait for one to bite. You're gonna have be waiting a long time if you do that. That's from the basics. If you want to graduate from using a stick or your finger, I personally just use an ultralight for a lot of my micro fishing. There's tenkara rods and just like extendable cane poles and stuff like that. What a lot of people get into a little more specialty are tanago hooks. So those are the pretty snelled, very small hooks that get down to about a size 30. They have weird and wonky shapes that kind of help catch smaller fish. They originated in like Eastern Asia and in Japan. They're meant to catch small fish. It wasn't just kind of like a weird, you know, side thing that happened. They're designed for it. Like you mentioned, a lot of fish are easier to catch at night. Certain darters definitely are. They have different colorations at night. A lot of times you'll notice log perch at night. They almost have very distinct black bars across their back or saddles. And then in the daytime, you only see the normal stripes that they get. I've been very confused at night a few times, but a lot of times it is easier to see. They can't see you as well. They're not as photosensitive as something like a mad tom. So you can kind of creep right up on them and put a worm in their face. And if they want it, they'll take it. And if not, you might be sitting there for a little while. That's one of the things with darter fishing is you kind of get a broken back by the end of the day, just from looking over and looking so close into the rocks for some of these fish. But yeah, nighttime is definitely a good place to look for them. All you need is some worms. I prefer red worms. They're just a little smaller than something like night crawlers. I also like to have a small pair of scissors. You can kind of trim the bait to the size that you need it. You know, a fraction of a piece of a tiny piece of worm could be too big to fit in their mouth. I've kind of found that looking for natural baits in the stream is a good way to target them. So stuff like mayfly and caddisfly larvae, if you're in a really healthy stream that has that sort of thing, that's in abundance, a lot of times you can flip over a rock that's right under your foot and find one of those. It's difficult to put it on a hook because they're very fragile, but if you can figure out how to do that, that's a really good way to catch some of the more picky darters and just any other micro species in general.
Yeah. So say it takes the bait. I assume you don't need to set the hook very hard, but what happens next? Like you get it on. How do you go about handling these very small fish once you land them?
Yeah, you definitely don't have to set the hook very hard. A lot of it is sight fishing. So you'll see right when it bites, especially for darters. At that point, you kind of just pull them out. I'll have my hand wet and ready to catch them because a lot of times they'll flick off.
Are your hooks usually barbed or unbarbed?
The tanago ones are unbarbed or very slightly barbed, but it's to the point where they could very easily just flick right off. A lot of people do use the fly hooks that are unbarbed.
So you got a wet hand and then what?
Yeah, wet hand. And then usually what I do, it depends on if I have stuff on me or if I have it on shore, if I'm waiting. I'll kind of just keep the fish loosely in my hand and underwater and just kind of do a hobble towards the shore. A lot of times you'll have a bucket or a photo tank. And once you get there, you can take the fish off the hook, put them in there, take some photos. I take a lot of photos just in my hand nowadays, just because it's quicker. A photo tank's a great thing to have. That way you can get some good pictures, especially if you need to identify what you're looking at. Let them go at that point.
I will say I was looking at iNaturalist before this call, and there are so many pictures of rainbow darters in photo tanks, and they're quite lovely. And they look kind of different, some of them. So it was really neat to kind of browse through those. So that is a good idea.
Yeah, I think they do have some variation. I think there's certain populations, maybe a little further west, like Arkansas or so, I believe I've caught some that have like red spots on their sides, which are kind of unique. Really, they range throughout pretty much all the Midwest, the Great Lakes drainages, upper Mississippi, a little bit down into the southeast as well in certain parts. So they have a really big range. I personally love rainbow darters as a sort of outreach species because they are pretty common where found in their range. They're gorgeous. And then again, for microfishing as well, they're super easy to catch if you can find them. That's the hard part at first, is just finding them, which Guy actually reminded me, rainbow darter was my first one as well. And I didn't know exactly what I was doing back then. So I was looking into these riffles way too deep into the riffle to where it starts to play with your eyes if you're looking in too much of the current. I think that was one of the catches that kind of threw me deeper into it, because that was one I had wanted for a while. They're just gorgeous. Everyone, you know, has to see one at least in person once in their lifetime.
You're stoked when you caught it. It's cool.
Yeah, definitely. They were kind of deeper in a riffle where the water was a little more broken up, but I could see them down there. I could see the color. These were just real colored up males, and I started freaking out. So I'm trying to figure out what exactly do I want to put on to give me the best chance in case I spook them. I had a bucket ready right next to me with some water in it. I'm sure my legs were shaking, and if I saw one look like it bit, I probably yanked my hook out of the water just to find nothing on it. It gets real exciting, especially in the beginning. And the more you catch, it's not like the excitement dies. Every time you see something new, it's like, oh my goodness, what am I looking at? And then you find out, and then you let it go, and yeah, hopefully you got a good picture. Tell your friends about it, help them when they want to go catch it, and vice versa. So there's a big community around it, and everyone is pretty helpful.
I always feel so good about myself when I catch a darter. Perhaps I shouldn't. Perhaps that's a reflection of my low aptitude for the couple's genera that are darters, but I always feel so happy. Chuffed to bits. Speaking about, okay, an outreach species and just kind of getting into this whole other sector of fishing that's maybe obscured to the typical anglers, what prompted you to get into micro fishing in the first place? And it sounds like you're kind of maybe self-taught. What resources have you discovered along the way that maybe you thought were, oh, this would have been super helpful when I was starting this 9 years ago?
Around when I started, maybe a year or two before then, I had been fishing just for sport fish for a little while. At one point, I just decided to go cast net in the stream and see what I could catch. I was pulling in like northern hog suckers and blunt-nosed minnows. And then one day I was just fishing with a small lure and I caught a river chub. And I thought, what in the world am I looking at? It had a pink head, a big pink bulbous head with all its tubercles. And I was like,
nice.
What in the world is this? You start looking at guidebooks and then you see everything else that's there. And so that got me into the idea of just seeing all these different fishes. In terms of starting out catching them, I think for me personally, it was just a lot of getting out there and putting a worm in front of a fish's mouth. And if it didn't bite, why is it not biting? Okay, let me go figure out if it eats something different. There's certain fish that won't bite. So just a lot of trial and error. The equipment's pretty simple. But in terms of finding the fish, that's usually the hardest part in a lot of cases. I say there's some fish that are easy to find, easy to catch. There's some fish that are easy to find, hard to catch. And there's kind of, you can make a Punnett square out of it and pick your poison. There's some fish that are hard to find and then you find them and they won't bite anything. So
sounds like you've kind of opened the door to like almost unlimited possibilities in terms of catching different fish. And we actually had Kevin Hutchinson, he's a grad student at Clemson. He reached out with some fan mail darter and he was asking Guy to maybe share life lists. He's an amphibian guy. We know people who like birds have their life list. Is this a thing in the fisheries world? What have you caught so far? Like, how big is your list? And is that something that really motivates you?
I keep a life list of my own. Again, I've been doing it since I was micro fishing. I'm somewhere in like the 430 range on hook and line. I think around half or so of those are like smaller freshwater fishes like rainbow darters. And then about half of that, so probably around 50 to 60 alone, is probably darters themselves.
Wow.
That's one of those ones you see all the colors and it's just like, okay, I need to go find that. Everything else is kind of put on the side burner or as bycatch, and then you find that and it's like mission accomplished.
Guy, how many do you have on your list?
Not nearly that many. I'm at like 240-ish.
Okay. I've got even less because I just keep fishing salmon.
Especially darters too. I think I only have like 6 darters. Darter diversity on my list is very low, and so I'm still working to try to improve that. I am curious, so you mentioned like 60 darters. I remember having a conversation one time with someone from Ohio, Scott Glassmeyer, and him talking about how it was easy to identify darters. And I'm like, you know, coming from Georgia, when I got down there for the first time, there's just so many darters. I honestly didn't put a ton of time into trying to figure out how to learn to tell all of them apart. But he was saying there's only like 5 or 6 species up there. So if you've got 60 darters, you must be traveling all over the place to catch these. Are you planning specific trips to go and hunt down darters? Or is it just when you happen to be in a place and you kind of do a survey of what diversity is there?
So yeah, it's typically planned out trips. I work nights, so I kind of say that I have my night shift job and then my day job is going and looking for fish. So I'll plan trips out, usually to certain places in the United States. I haven't traveled much into the Western U.S. yet, but I've been throughout a lot of the Southeast. States like Tennessee, Kentucky, Alabama, they all have great diversity in general, but especially of darters. Alabama has amazing diversity, and I've actually only touched the surface there. Just last week, I was in Kentucky for a little over a week for the NAMPA convention. That is just all types of fish enthusiasts, but that includes people who are microfishing. The mascot for that convention was actually a splendid darter, Kentucky and Tennessee, gorgeous fish.
What's at the top of both y'all's lists? What do you most want to get next?
I'm not good at picking a favorite of a lot of things, and especially darters. There's so many. I have my full life list and then an Ohio specific life list. So there's a handful of fishes that I've caught in other states that I still need to catch in Ohio that I usually just put on the back burner for an out of state trip. So that's the thing that I've been trying to focus on a little bit more recently.
Okay, how about you? Is there one that's eluded you that's making you frustrated or?
So one that's glaringly missing is long-nosed gar. And I don't know, it's embarrassing that I don't have it yet. Darter wise, just basically everything. I feel embarrassed to be talking about considering how relatively few fish that I have compared to.
I didn't
to, like,
plan to embarrass you, I'm sorry.
No, but I'll try and come up with a target here and there, but I don't keep track of it all that much, and I don't have like a single one that's sort of been eluding me, so to speak. I'll catch more fish as my life goes on, I'm sure.
Yeah, that's a life list. You got plenty of time.
Yeah. So you got your Ohio specific list. What sort of things are still missing from that that you're trying to put together?
Oh, you know, there's just stuff that I haven't gotten around to. Dusky darter is one off the top of my head that I just haven't gotten down into the Southeast Ohio area where they're a little more common. Tadpole mad tom is another one I've caught in at least 3 other states, including Kentucky last week, and I just haven't gotten around. Those are more in Northwest Ohio, more common up there. Lots of bigger stuff. Some of the suckers, I love suckers, but in terms of fishing for them, I don't claim to be very good at it. And so I usually don't fish them during the run or anything. Usually certain times of year, I'm busy looking for darters or something else smaller, which I imagine, Guy, you probably, even though I've caught more species, I figure you probably caught a lot more standard size freshwater fishes than myself, especially being out west. You probably caught a lot of stuff that I haven't, which I think is really cool because everyone has their own experiences. They have their own list and they're all unique. I think the farthest west I've been at this point was like central Oklahoma, and that was from the NAMPA convention last year.
I gotta get to that convention. That sounds like fun. From an aquarium standpoint, how many tanks do you have? What do you have in your tanks? And I guess, how does that marry itself with your microfishing?
So currently I'm a little limited in my apartment, but right now I do have some pygmy sunfish. Those are a great kind of low maintenance fish. As long as you give them some live food, they're pretty easy to keep. But I have caught and kept some darters in aquarium before. They're great. They have a lot of personalities. You get to the point where they look like little puppy dogs coming up to the tank, and you know, it's really cool. I know certain states have legality issues with collecting certain fishes for aquariums, but if you're allowed to do it, check your regulations. And if you can, go out there and find some.
You mentioned earlier that these guys really like flow. So if you have them in an aquarium setting, are there any particular considerations that you have to take into account when setting up appropriate habitat that they'll thrive in?
Yeah, certain darters will want more flow, but rainbow darters in particular, if you have a powerhead or some other smaller wave maker or something that'll give them a little bit of flow, they usually stay pretty happy. They're not too picky.
When you've been fishing for rainbow darters in particular, what other species have you seen coexisting with them? And is there anything they can be confused with given all the beautiful darters? Or is it pretty easy to kind of be like, that's a rainbow darter, and then there's these other cool fish around them?
If they're in the riffles out here, there's like streamline chubs. That's one you usually see alongside them pretty often. Sometimes just other darters, greenside darters and banded darters. One of the most commonly confused ones with rainbow darters are going to be the orange throat darters. So they're pretty closely related. They look fairly similar in some respects. A couple of the easiest ways to differentiate them are the orange throat darters. They're going to have like a blue anal fin, and the rainbow darters, they'll have a blue anal fin, but it'll have red kind of in the middle. So the blue surrounds it. That's an easy way. The orange throats usually have more of a developed teardrop below their eye as well, so kind of like a darker, dusky area. Their stripes don't go quite up as far close to their face on their body. But yeah, they do overlap in range in certain places. One of the things that happens once you are in the realm of microfishing for a little while is you can look at a fish and say you're looking for a new one, a new species. A lot of times, if you caught a bunch of rainbow darters, you can tell from above, hey, that's a rainbow darter. I'm not going to put my hook anywhere near that. Because like I said, they are pretty aggressive. From above, you can tell a lot of darters and other species. Some of them, like certain shiners, you kind of just have to pull them out of the water and figure them out then. From above, certain darters will have saddles or coloration. Sometimes if you can put your head to the side and see a little bit of the side of their body, you can tell a little better. Usually having them out of the water is the best way. Get a good side profile and quick photo.
Have you ever combined snorkeling with microfishing?
Yeah.
Okay.
There's definitely pros and cons to it. But yeah, I mean, if you have the equipment, wetsuit, that's a great way to go about it. If you can tolerate the water, you can do it just in swim trunks or, you know, swim gear and a snorkel. And all that requires is the same sort of stuff fishing wise for the equipment. I would actually recommend a stick underwater because it's such close quarters. That something like a longer rod is going to be a lot harder to manage. So small stick or even like a nice fishing rod, you can put a fixed line on there and get underwater and start looking. It's very cool. There's times where I've felt like I went a mile underwater and I pick my head up out of the water and it looks like I went about 10 or 20 feet. So you can really get lost down there. You can see the fish in their habitat a lot better. But they are pretty personable. I think fish are adapted to get scared of the things they see from above. And once you're underwater with them, they are pretty comfortable in a lot of instances.
Tell that to a bridled darter. Those things scoot around. They don't like you. I have poor eyesight. I always need to put my face under the water to see them. Maybe that's why I haven't caught as many darters, is because I have to be in the water with them to see them take stuff, or I need more practice looking at them topside, because I have such a hard time with that. I'm curious, Cody, you know, Katrina asked a little bit about motivation earlier, but I'm wondering if you could dig into that a little bit. This is something that I struggle sometimes when talking to people to articulate, but, you know, there is something natural that humans feel about collecting things, and so I think that's part of the sense of building these species lists. What is it that really drives you and gets you wanting to go out, keep searching for these darters? And are rainbow darters still, are you still excited when you catch them? Or has it gotten to the point where this is something that you've seen so much that the thrill is maybe passed a little bit?
Yeah, I'll start with that second part. So rainbow darters, I still do enjoy seeing them, especially when it's your first time getting out in the year. That's especially exciting. If you've caught a handful in the same day, sometimes it starts to slow down, but I think that happens with any fish. In terms of motivation, everyone should have some sort of hobby or something that they look forward to, and this has just kind of developed into mine, as it has for a lot of people. So yeah, the collecting aspect, just having a list where you can see it all, and I think just in general, just celebrating biodiversity, just seeing how many of these fish have the same body type, but they look different on the side. And why does this one act different than this one? And why does this one live in this place and that one lives there? I wouldn't have traveled nearly as much as I have if I wasn't out there looking for fishes. The first major road trip I ever took was to the NAMFA convention in Mississippi, and that was in 2019. And I learned so much about life outside of Ohio on that trip. It was amazing. And I got to meet a lot of cool people that I'm friends with to this day, and just supports my hobby, supports my well-being. And yeah, like I said, I think everyone should have something like that. I think it should be fish for everyone. But
me too.
Agree.
I like that idea of celebrating diversity, and I didn't think about that with those lists. I'm not good at keeping lists, but I do like that idea. That's a good way to visualize that. Man, NAMFA, I'm starting to get very much FOMO hearing all these folks on this show talk about that convention.
Did you find NAMFA you started microfishing and then you find this NAMFA group, or was it the reverse?
I was definitely microfishing back then, so I think I found microfishing before then. I mentioned kind of netting some of those non-game smaller species and wondering what they were. When you start looking into guides and stuff like that, or learning about some of these fish, you're gonna come across an article from NAMFA related to NAMFA. Someone helps you ID something and they're a part of NAMFA. There's usually someone related that'll kind of pull you in. And of course, if you're interested in it, that's what they're all about.
We should probably say what that acronym stands for in case folks didn't catch the last episode.
Yeah, NAMFA is North American Native Fishes Association. It's a group across the nation that just focuses on exactly what it says, North American Native Fishes. They have that annual convention. So this year it was in Kentucky, and it just got announced that it's going to be in Ohio next year.
Hey!
Yeah, so that'll be my shortest drive over the last handful of years. It's just a real great organization that works with everyone and all the fishes.
Is this hobby very different than your night job? I guess your day job? Because, yeah, a lot of our guests are, like, professional, like, fish biologists. But we had a football coach and teacher on last week, and I'm just curious if this is very different than your regular job.
So I'm actually a registered nurse in the NICU here in Ohio. It is pretty different. One thing I like to think about it is I think there's probably something in my head that drew me to the babies, same as just the smaller fish. I have a tendency to go towards those things that are, I don't know, just they can't advocate for themselves as much. If you care about these fish and seeing them, looking at them, keeping them, anything, you can always help in some way, and there's always something to get out of it for you and the fish.
You've got a nice little, at least on Instagram, social media profile that you curate and show off the fish you catch. I'm just curious what your perspective is generally on the connection between social media and this online community of kind of fish enthusiasts, fish nerds, and the world of fishing.
There was one profile I saw a long time ago that kind of bumped me maybe into the life listing world a little bit as well. Every month or two, I have someone else follow me that's this person's life list, that person's life list. I mean, the internet in general is a place to connect with people, and it's a good place to talk to people about things that you enjoy. The coach you mentioned from last week, Dylan, he's actually a good friend. He was part of our NAMFA group. So he does more of the aquarium keeping. Yeah. I do more of like the angling and just taking photos. There's all types of communities for life listing, microfishing, and just like-minded people that want to do the same thing you want to do. You can coordinate trips. You can talk about what this fish is and where you found this one. There's unlimited possibilities. And that's one of the things that's great is I can't foresee ever accomplishing all the goals I have. There's just always room for something to do, always another trip you can plan.
From a conservation standpoint, when you're doing these trips and seeing all these places, have you noticed any like environmental impacts that folks just doing kind of regular day jobs could get out and help with? Do you have any like conservation observations through your travels?
Yeah, definitely. It's all this regular stuff you would see, just keeping the stream clean. A lot of places that you can access water to catch new species are public parks. You'll find some trash. So that's a good thing to watch out for your safety and just for the well-being of the stream. Other than that, a lot of it's kind of bigger things that you almost want to rally for to get taken care of. Streamside damage or certain agricultural practices that can affect streams. From stories I've personally heard, a lot of times you talk to people who own streamside property and you tell them what's in there, you show them pictures, show them some rainbow darters, and they'll be like, wow, I had no idea those were in there. Those are really cool.
Do you have any stories that immediately come to mind with the rainbow darter or other species where you've shown people and gotten that sort of effect?
Yeah, definitely. There's a stream not too far south of me that I love. It's one of my local streams I've caught more species out of than any other. The one day I was snorkel fishing actually. I was looking at rainbow darters and I was catching them and I was putting them in a little photo tank. This is in the middle of a fairly public park. Naturally, there's a few people that come up and think there's a dead body floating in the water because they just see a figure and, not much going on. And yeah, when people come up to you and you have some fish ready, just show what's in the stream. Again, even rainbow darters, if you see them from above, you can't see the color very well. So unless you catch them, there's not much to see or to be in awe of. And so catching those fish and being able to show people is one of my favorite parts. The look on people's faces when they see some of these fish. Again, even something like a greenside darter or banded darter, those are fairly common as well. A lot of bright greens on them. That's just another one where it's like, wow, that's amazing.
I was out in Cullowhee a couple days ago and I caught a real colored up gilt darter. And I'd been talking to this guy about fly fishing for trout in the parking lot before I went, and we went our separate ways. I ran over and showed it to him. Then later in the day, I brought back a really colored up Tennessee shiner to show him. And he said, oh no, that first fish that you showed me, I was looking at and I saw a bunch of them and they're hanging out on the rocks. And I'd never seen these things in here before. And you're telling me they're all over the place. And so it was really cool. Now, granted, this guy is already at least sort of in the fishing conservation sort of space, so it's kind of attuned to what's in the water, but to have them go from not knowing that these fish were in there to then recognizing, I don't know if they're actually the same species, if they were gilt darters or something else, but seeing darters on the rocks and kind of knowing what they were in a span of a half hour, I thought was really pretty cool.
Yeah, it's kind of crazy. Anywhere you go, even here in Anchorage, I mean, we have baby salmon in the creeks and you can't see them unless you're like actually getting down in there, so I think people are usually surprised to learn what's actually in their backyard.
Oh yeah, when you're talking about fish that we want to catch, the Alaska blackfish, those guys.
Oh yeah.
I'd love to come over there. I almost planned a trip this year or next year whenever I had like a week off.
I know where they are.
It'd really be a trip kind of surrounded around them, catching them and getting some photographs and stuff. So, yeah.
Okay. You could get some sticklebacks, Alaska blackfish, some sculpins, maybe some dollies, rainbows, coho salmon.
Yeah. Yeah. Another state too. Yeah.
Yeah.
How nerdy are your all's spreadsheets? Like, how many columns do you have? What all's in your spreadsheet? Are you using Excel? Like, how do people go about this if they actually want to keep one of these lists?
Yeah, certain people do use the Excel lists. Me personally, I do my schedule. I do all my stuff just in the Notes app on my phone. So I have one app that just has my complete life list. I have it broken down into basically freshwater micros, saltwater micros, and then standard freshwater and standard saltwater. So all those will add up to the total. I have my Ohio list on a separate note, and then I have a separate note from that just for the states that I've been to. I tend to keep it pretty simple. I have an album that has all the photos as well. I think a lot of people do like to use Excel and just other programs like that to keep track. It's real nice to delete and add.
Sort and stuff.
Yeah, of course. And some people will keep track of certain hybrids that are interesting and just other weird variations of fish. In terms of life listing for fish, most people refer to catching on hook and line as their life list, but there's other people who will use nets and stuff like that too. Because again, it does all come back down to just wanting to see these fish and see the diversity.
Guy, I'm guessing you got an Excel spreadsheet that's pretty in-depth.
Yeah, and I have thoughts on it, and it, if I started talking about it, it would go too long,
we'll
and
do
it
a
would
separate
distract
episode
from
on
Cody's
that.
Time in the limelight. So, yeah, when we got just you and me, I can do a deep dive into how I structure that, because I certainly have some regrets around how I've done it, although I'm learning, so I have advice. If you're thinking about starting a life list, wait a couple months until you hear the episode where I go into my misgivings about what I've done.
Yeah, certain people have locations on there. They have what bait they used and how many they caught that day, just all types of stuff like that. So, yeah, I totally understand. They can be very simple or very complex.
Yeah. When NANFA comes to Ohio next year, Cody, you're kind of by default, I guess, be cast into guide mode, I think. You don't have to, like, name names. I'm not asking you to give coordinates or anything, but are there any spots where you're really excited that maybe you'll take people out?
Yeah, definitely. If it's anywhere within a couple hours of the center of the state, which it will be, I've got spots for certain things. Big Darby Creek, that's our mm-hmm. most diverse stream. There's a lot of access on it, and there's a lot of cool fish to find in there.
Yeah, I think we were talking about... Was that the, do they got Tippecanoe darters in there?
That was Tippecanoe, yeah.
Was that Tippecanoe? Yeah.
There are Tippecanoe darters. Those will actually be delisted as a state protected species. That was part of Brian Zimmerman's talk, so that was really, really cool to hear. Their populations are doing great in Ohio now.
I do have to ask, how was it going to Australia and catching all those fish? Because I was super jealous of all your pictures. They just look so different than anything I've ever seen. It was really cool.
Last September, I went to Australia up in far north Queensland. The first time out of the country, I figured it'd probably be a pretty easy place to get around. I spent a lot of time looking for freshwater stuff that's kind of more endemic or local up in that part of the country. And I did a little bit of saltwater fishing as well. I saw a stonefish, which I didn't even try to catch. It was really, really cool. There was a stonefish next to a moray eel, and then there was an epaulette shark too. They were all right next to each other. I have a photo of those. Lots of cool stuff to see in Australia.
What was the coolest freshwater endemic that you caught?
I would say my favorite freshwater fish. They're not endemic. They're also found in Papua New Guinea and all by West Papua. But the Mouth Almighty, they are a freshwater mouth-brooding cardinal fish. So most of their family is restricted to the saltwater. But Papua has a handful of species, but in Australia, you only find the Mouth Almighty. It's kind of just a brown fish, but again, just the mouth-brooding and the freshwater aspect of them, it is a little more unique, and I found them... I think it was my last day of fishing, so I was super excited about that.
So we've got how many fish are in the world? 30,000? Like, how far into all the fish are you going to get by the end of your career as a microfisherman?
Oh, you know, I have no idea. So, yeah, I think there's somewhere probably between 35 and 40,000, something like that. Who knows at this point? For me personally, I don't have any one goal. I know certain people do make numerical goals. For me, I'm just kind of here for the ride. I have friends who are just starting that I talk to it about. And I have friends that have caught 1,000, 2,000 species, have traveled to so many countries. A lot of those guys haven't caught some of the stuff I've caught, and they have caught a lot of stuff I haven't, of course. So again, everyone's list is kind of unique, and you always just go towards what you have time for and what you're interested
in. Yeah. Guy and I were trying to figure out how many generations of hosts we need to make Fish of the Week cover all the fish, and it's a lot.
I thought you were going to say trying to get someone to catch all the fish, and I'm thinking, I just started thinking about deep sea fish and... Never mind.
Just thinking about dropping down some real small hooks real deep and seeing what kind of weird, funky, smaller fish you might catch. I have friends who've gone out on like charter boats and gotten weird looks of like, why do you have such small hooks? Why are you trying to catch these tiny fish? And everyone's trying to catch fish to eat.
Hypothetically, would you count this on your list, Cody? Because, you know, you talk about way deep. If you start to pull them up, it'd turn into like a blobless, amorphous sort of mess. These fish are like at thousands and thousands of feet. So if you had a like ROV with a hook on one end and you're able to bring the fish to a certain point and ID it and then just kind of let the line go slack and hopefully it comes off or have a way to like cut the line. If you were operating the ROV, would you count that?
I know with birding, you can just kind of hear the bird, or some people just like to see it. I like to get a decent photo to identify. Something like that seems like it'd be a little risky, so I think I would pass on that. But hey, everyone has their own list. Whatever you want to count, you count.
How about you, Gay?
If I was operating it and I could get, the question is at what point is it satisfactorily caught? I suppose what I might have is like a chamber that if I wanted to, I could bring the whole thing back up to the surface, but that would probably release it at depth. But get the photo. I think getting the photo is important.
I didn't know we were going to go there. What else are we missing in terms of rainbow darter? I know we're coming on time here. Is there anything else you want to say about that particular fish or just inspiring folks to get into this pursuit and be inspired by biodiversity?
Year after year, they're still exciting. They're gorgeous fish. Just knowing that they're there is a great thing. They're important. They're a good indicator species of clean habitat, clean streams. Get out there and look for them if you're anywhere near them. And if you're not, there's probably something else to look for, a fish that you've never heard of. Again, get out there, travel, and just have fun.
All right. Well, thanks, Cody. This was super cool.
Appreciate you coming on.
Yeah, this was awesome. Thanks.
Okay. We'll get out there and live with, live from, discover, and enjoy all the fish, especially the rainbow darter. Thanks for listening to Fish of the Week. This podcast is a production of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, Alaska Region. We hope you continue to develop your interest and love for America's fish and the beautiful places they live.
Fiber Plus Internet is now available in Sandpoint and King Cove. GCI offers high-speed internet in your community at the same plans and pricing as in Anchorage. More information is available at gci.com/internet.
You're listening to Statewide News from Alaska Public Media. I'm Ava White. The Alaska Department of Corrections is holding dozens of immigration detainees in an Anchorage jail and violating federal standards by denying them access to their attorneys and consulates, and in one incident, subjecting them to pepper spray. That's what attorneys representing some of the men told Alaska legislators at a hearing on Friday. Immigration attorney Cindy Woods of the ACLU of Alaska has spoken to five of the men. She testified that the detainees have been held in lockdown for substantial periods since ICE transferred 41 men from Washington State to Alaska on June 8th.
Individuals are being held 2 to 3 in a cell with one open air toilet in a cell. In cells that are holding 3 people, one person must sleep on the floor, abutting a toilet that cannot be flushed on demand, but is flushed twice an hour.
The hearing shows how President Trump's crackdown on immigration is straining federal holding facilities and that Alaska prisons aren't an easy substitute. The Anchorage Correctional Complex has a contract to house federal detainees. In early June, ICE transferred the men to Anchorage to relieve overcrowding at a federal immigration facility near Tacoma, Washington. Democratic Representative Andrew Gray of Anchorage called the hearing. He repeatedly cited the ways the Department of Corrections is violating humane standards established during the first Trump administration for immigration detainees. Alaska Corrections Commissioner Jen Winkleman was the first witness. She said the detention was going well after a number of what she called bumps in the road. She said guards deployed pepper spray, not at anyone, but in the room to enforce a lockdown. The Federal Board of Geographic Names has rejected a proposal to name a summit in Denali National Park and Preserve after a longtime mining pioneer, the Alaska Beacon reports. Michelle Stevens, daughter of Corolla June Young, proposed naming the peak Mount Corolla to honor her mother. And the proposal had been supported by the Talkeetna Historical Society, the Matanuska-Susitna Borough Planning Commission, the Alaska Miners Association, and the Alaska Historical Commission, which voted 6-1 to support the nomination. But on June 12th, the Domestic Names Committee of the U.S. Board on Geographic Names rejected the nomination. The board, along with the Secretary of the Interior, is responsible for maintaining geographic names in the country. Wendy Sailors, Community Engagement Manager for Alaska State Parks, said that the federal board rejected the Mount Corolla name because it violated the policy for names in wilderness areas. It is somewhat unusual for an Alaska name nomination to be rejected at the federal level because names must be vetted by the Alaska Historical Commission beforehand. This is Alaska Public Media.
The Alaska Morning News is brought to you in part by
GCI, keeping schools and students connected across the state with a resilient and redundant network. Details at gci.com/education.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, dedicated to improving the learning experience for America's students by sharing what works in pre-K through 12 education at edutopia.org.
You're listening to Statewide News from Alaska Public Media. I'm Ava White. Lightning caused new wildfires in the hot interior over the weekend, and others that started last week got big enough to close two major highways, one to Anchorage and one to the North Slope. KUAC's Robin reports.
The Parks Highway between Healy and Anderson, or if you use a larger scale, between Fairbanks and Anchorage, was closed part of Saturday, part of Sunday, and may be closed today as the Bear Creek Fire grows and jumps the road.
It's growing on the other side of the road now. It has made the jump.
Sam Harrell, speaking from a busy Alaska Fire Service office, says the fire has jumped the highway in a few places along the corridor. The Bear Creek Fire is now 26,000 acres. A handful of homes, cabins, and other structures have burned. Harrell says there are some short windows in which it's safe enough to get some vehicles through a 20-mile section of the Bear Creek Fire area, escorted by a Department of Transportation pilot vehicle.
They're holding traffic at 259 and 278. And when it's clear that they can see or there's no flame in the roadway, then it's safe for a pilot car to take a string of vehicles through.
But the situation remains dynamic, and motorists are waiting hours at each end. Rob Allen, the Northern Region Fire Management Officer for the Division of Forestry and Fire Protection, says more firefighters are coming starting today.
We've got a jet load of crews coming in from the lower 48. There's four crews on that. We're getting two of those crews. There's another jet load coming in on Wednesday. We'll get two of those and another jet load, I believe, on Friday. We've also reached out to the state of Oregon. They've got some contract crews, and they're going to be sending up some.
Allen was hoping to hold an in-person briefing session for residents of the Haystack Mountain neighborhoods off the Elliott Highway north of Fairbanks. But the Himalaya Road fire made him change his plans as it grew to 3,300 acres on Sunday. Rangers and Alaska State Troopers went door to door Sunday afternoon to deliver evacuation orders in those neighborhoods. Fairbanks North Star Borough Mayor Grier Hopkins was being interviewed Sunday night when the borough's alert system pinged another evacuation.
What sort of entrance and exit to various subdivisions are available? For example, like Himalaya Road and the Hayes Creek that we all just heard the alert for are one way in, one way out. So there's only one road accessing it because if the fire moves that way, they can't go.
Then troopers and DOT closed the Elliott Highway. That's the road out of Fairbanks that connects to the Dalton and the industrial traffic headed to the Arctic. The evacuations caused by the Himalaya Road fire and a couple of other fires around Fairbanks means people need a place to take their animals. For both pets and livestock that are evacuated, there's a new Fairbanks North Star Borough facility stood up at the new Emergency Operations Building on Pegger Road. Sandy Hill is the animal control manager. She has staff at the new emergency shelter 24 hours a day during the fire activity. But so far, there has not been much demand because she thinks evacuated pets are finding temporary homes with friends in the community.
You know, we've only housed two dogs in our shelter, and we haven't had any requests for any livestock.
She says there's room for livestock both at the new stand-up facility and overflow at the animal shelter building. But evacuated pets will be cared for at the emergency shelter so they don't mix with animals waiting for adoption at the regular animal shelter. It was cooler on Sunday with less lightning and is predicted to be cloudier and cooler Monday and Tuesday. That could be the advantage firefighter teams are looking for. In Fairbanks, I'm Robin.
This is Alaska Public Media.
It's a beautiful morning.
Yeah, coming up we have little Chris Christopherson with Road Warriors Lament. But before that, I must say, good morning everybody out here in Paradise. Another beautiful day, no wind, just a touch of participation, or precipitation, I should say. Another beautiful day. I love this time of year, I really do. Starting out, we got Christopher Christopherson with Road Warriors Lament. I've got Johnny Cash with Let 'Em Roll. Then a little Brooks and Dunn with Lost and Found.
There's a silence full of stars, for as far as I can see, in the silence where you are, do you ever dream of me? The moon is dark, the night is silver, while perfume is on the breeze. I feel the stars, cold as forever, half as true, you and me. I'll be your friend, I'll be your lover, I'll be whatever you ever need, right to the end, until it's over. I swear to you, you can count on me. Thank you.
let him roll, boys, let him roll. I'll bet he's gone to Dallas, rest his soul. Now he was a wino, tried and true, done about everything there is to do. He worked on freighters, he worked in bars, he worked on farms, and he worked on cars. Now it was white port wine that put that look in his eye that grown men get when they need to cry. And we sat down on the curb to rest, and his head just fell down on his chest. He said every single day it gets just a little bit harder to handle, and yet then he lost a thread and his mind got cluttered and the words just rolled off down the gutter. He was an elevator man in a cheap hotel in exchange for the rent on a one-room cell. And he's years old before his time, no thanks to the world and the white port wine. So he says, son, he always called me son. He said, life for you has just begun. And then he told me the story that I'd heard before, how he fell in love with a Dallas whore. He could cut through the years to the very night that it all ended in a whorehouse fight, and she turned his last proposal down in favor of being a girl about town. Now it's been 17 years right in line, and he ain't been straight none of the time. It's too many years of fighting the weather and too many nights of not being together. So he died. Let him roll, boys, let him roll. I'll bet he's gone to Dallas, rest his soul. Let him roll, boys, let him roll. He always thought that heaven was just a Dallas hole. When they went through his personal effects, in among the stubs from the welfare checks was a crumbling picture of a girl in a door and a dress in Dallas and nothing more. Well, the welfare people provided the priest, and a couple from the mission down the street sang Amazing Grace. Nobody cried except some lady in black way off to the side. We all left and she's standing there, the black veil covering that silver hair. And old one-eyed John said her name was Alice. She used to be a whore in Dallas. Let him roll, boys, let him roll. I bet he's gone to Dallas, rest his soul. Let him roll, boys, let him roll. He always thought that heaven was just a Dallas hole. Let him roll.
It is the game. cars are waiting right outside. But I don't wanna think about who's taking her for a ride. And her unpredictability is what I love about her best. But I got to find her quick, before she does something I'll regret. It's kind of like a lost and found in a border town. You're asking about a diamond ring. They just look at you like you've lost your mind. Say they haven't seen a thing. But I know she's been here lately. I can still smell her perfume. If she gets crazy on a full moon, she's out there somewhere, burning up the night. Somehow I got to run her down. I'm running out of time. It's kind of like a lost and found in a border town. Asking about it. Lost.